Support for The Trend on WNIN comes from members of the Local Programming Fund. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Every year, One Book, One Community of Southwestern Indiana picks a book for the community to read and then invites the author to Evansville to speak. This year's book is the New York Times bestselling novel, The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society, which tells the story of how books bring people together and build community during and after the German occupation of one of the Channel Islands. I'm joined by one of the book's authors, Annie Barrows. She's on the phone from her home in Northern California. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Micah.
And when I say one of the book's authors, that's because the book was conceived and started by your aunt, Mary Ann Schaefer, who sadly passed away in 2008, just before the book was published. What was she like?
Oh, Mary Ann was probably the best storyteller I have ever or will ever meet. And if I want to introduce her to people who have read the book, I say that Mary Ann's voice was a lot like Juliet's voice in the book, and that gives a pretty good sense of what it was like to be around her and how much fun she was.
Now, how did this book come about?
Well, Mary Ann found herself in Guernsey once upon a time and discovered that the island had been occupied by the Germans during the Second World War. And like most Americans, she had never heard of this phenomenon before and became utterly fascinated by it. And so some years later, when she was being goaded to write a book by her friends, she began to write this story, the story that eventually became the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society. And, you know, from my perspective, as somebody who knew Mary Ann, you know, for years and years and years, I also can see themes and characters that I know she loved her entire life appearing in the book as well.
And you became involved later on as her health was failing. How did that come about?
Well, Mary Ann had finished a manuscript of the book, and it had sold, and that was, you know, amazing and wonderful. But very shortly after the book was bought by the Dial Press, Mary Ann got sick, and then when the editor came back a couple of months later with a lot of rewrites, Mary Ann didn't think she could start the whole thing again. And that's when she called me. I was at the dentist, and she called me and said, you know, you're the other writer in the family. Can you take this project on? So that's how I got involved. You know, little did I know it was going to turn into this amazing juggernaut, enormous bestseller. It was a wonderful process for me as a writer, but it also turned into this fabulous entity, this fabulous entertainment for all these people, and that's been an amazing thing.
When you began working on that manuscript, did you have a sense of how this would grab people's imaginations and emotions?
Well, I think that I felt pretty confident that it was, I mean, I knew it was a wonderful book, and I knew that Mary Ann was a brilliant, genius storyteller. I mean, I'd known that all my life, and now I had the feeling that the rest of the world was going to find out, you know, just what a Scheherazade we had in our family. But I didn't think it was going to turn into this, you know, as I say, international juggernaut that it has become.
So for those of us who have not yet written a novel, tell me about the process. What happens when you go from manuscript that's been sold to how much has to happen in terms of revisions and so forth before this thing actually comes out with a cover on it?
Well, there, you know, different books, different processes. You know, I am always one to try and persuade my editors that they need not touch a single word of my prose, but they don't usually pay very much attention to me. In this particular instance, the main thing that I was to do, the main focus of the editorial work, was to make the book longer. Not so much to change what was there, but to add to it. The book, you know, many people complain that the book is too short, but it was a lot shorter before I got involved. So I added more detail throughout the story. My task was not to finish up something that was unfinished. It was to go through the entire thing and make more.
Which, to me, that almost sounds harder. I mean, you have to take on the voices of your aunt's writing, and of course, and what, like 20 characters in the book?
26.
26.
I counted.
was
yeah,
that hard?
It was, I mean, I guess you could say it was It was hard. I mean, it certainly seemed like it was going to be hard, but once I got started, I felt so at home with these people. As I say, you know, I grew up with my Aunt Marianne. I knew some of these characters. I knew some of these characters personally, and their voices were kind of clonking around in my head. I could hear where they would go. And so I think that I had this enormous advantage of knowing the voice so intimately that I could follow it anywhere. It was actually glorious. But I think if I hadn't been in the position of growing up with my co-author, I think it would have been pretty darn difficult.
Did she give you direction when she handed it over?
Yes, she did give me some direction. We met, we had one big long meeting where I said, this is what I would do with, you know, the editor's letter. I would do this. And she said, yes, go. No, don't do that. Yes, go. But that was pretty much it, because she really was pretty sick. So once I had that kind of map that she and I worked out together, I was more or less on my own.
So how do you feel as an author? Do you feel like this is your book?
Do I feel like it's my book? That's a very good question. I think I do, because, you know, I know which pieces I wrote, and I am very proud of having made the book, having finished the book. But I think where I really get the most pride is that nobody can tell where Marianne leaves off and I begin. And so it really does, it presents the Marianne's own voice. And I think that is extremely important to me. I wanted the world to see what Marianne could do. We all wanted, my whole family, we're all dying for Marianne to write a book her entire life. And I feel like the thing I could be most proud of is that I helped to make that happen.
I want to get just a little flavor of what the book sounds like by listening to part of a letter that's written, and it tells a bit of what goes on in this Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society. Let's take a listen.
From Juliet to Dorsey, 11th of April, 1946. Dear Mr. Adams, after promising never to write to me again, Adelaide Addison has sent me another letter. It is devoted to all the people and practices she deplores, and you are one of them, along with Charles Lamb. It seems she called on you to deliver the April issue of the Parish Magazine, and you were nowhere to be found. Not milking your cow, not hoeing your garden, not washing your house, not doing anything a good farmer should be doing. So she entered your barnyard, and lo, what did she see? You, lying up in your hayloft, reading a book by Charles Lamb. You were so enraptured with that drunkard, you failed to notice her presence. What a blight that woman is. Do you happen to know why? I lean toward a malignant fairy at her christening. In any event, the picture of you lolling in the hay reading Charles Lamb pleased me very much.
And that's the style of the book, that it's written in letters. And one of the great themes in this book is the power of literature to change people's lives. It's a book about books on some level.
Yes, and I think that is quintessentially Marianne as well, because if I think of Marianne, just my automatic default image of Marianne is of her sitting at her dining room table with a stack of books on her left-hand side and a cup of fairly cold coffee and cigarettes on her right side, and she would pick up the top book off that stack, begin to read it, finish it, slam it down on the other side, and pick up the next book. She could do that for hours. So, you know, she herself was the embodiment of this other world.
We're talking with author Annie Barrows about the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society. Annie Barrows will be in Evansville to speak on Wednesday. We'll have more after a break. This is The Trend.
Thank you. You're listening to The Trend on 88.3 WNIN. Support for the program today comes from our contributing listeners. Thank you very much. And also through a grant from the Charles and Jan Stimftonagle family, who encourage your support of public broadcasting.
This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer, talking with Annie Barrows, one of the authors of the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society. It's this year's selection for One Book, One Community of Southwestern Indiana. Annie, I want to ask you about the source material for this, because as you mentioned earlier, this is about this kind of unknown corner of World War II history, this German occupation of one of the Channel Islands. How did Mary, I guess primarily Mary Ann, research this story?
Well, she began by finding some books about the occupation while she was on Guernsey, which is a kind of a strange story. We don't know why she went to Guernsey, but while she was there, she found a couple of books about the occupation. When she left Guernsey after spending a few hours there and came home, and for the next 20 years, she became more and more fascinated with Guernsey, read everything she could find on the occupation, as well as a pretty hefty dose of literature about resistance organizations throughout Europe and, you know, the Second World War in general. So she did research and research and research. She loved research. And when I came on the project, I went to her bookshelf and I saw just how much work she had done. I didn't have time to do quite that much, but she had put in so many hours and done so much groundwork, I didn't really have to.
And I'm sure I'm not alone in saying this was my introduction to the German occupation of Guernsey. How accurate is this book to history?
Oh, every word is true. Most people, most Americans have been very surprised to learn of this story about the Second World War, but the way that I feel, that I feel very confident in the research, because when I go to Guernsey, they don't protest the recounting of the story in the book. So I feel like we've done a pretty good job. Pretty much everything that, you know, is of historical record in the book really did happen. I mean, there were potato peel pies, even. There were...
Tell us what a potato peel pie is.
Oh, it's a ghastly concoction. A potato peel pie is a potato pie without a crust. Actually, the crust is made of the potato peels, and then you take the potato innards and glop them on top of the potato peels. But the really hideous part of the dish is that you can't really cook it for very long because you have no fuel because you're in the middle of an occupation. So when you eat it, it's kind of crunchy. It's hideous. But this
wow.
is exactly the kind of thing that they did really eat during the occupation because there wasn't anything else but potatoes to eat.
And they sweetened it to make it a sweet pie?
Yeah, with beets.
Terrible. Exactly.
Yeah, it's awful. I mean, the beets they sort of help the look of the thing. I made one. I made one and ate it. I made a genuine occupation pie, you know, cooking it for as short a time as possible. And the beets make it look good. If you kind of cross your eyes a little, it kind of looks like a raspberry tart because it's pink, but then it tastes like paste. It's awful.
But it speaks to the hardship. I guess you have to use potato peels because there is no flour available during
Absolutely,
the occupation.
Absolutely, yeah. Flour ran out altogether by 1944, but there was not a whole lot to be. There was not enough for such frivolity as pie crusts for, you know, about a year and a half before that. So that's why you use the potato peel for the crust. I mean, it does fill you up. You do feel full afterwards. There's just it doesn't taste very good, and it doesn't really give you much in the way of nutrition.
Now, I've got to ask you about the style of the book. It's written in the form of letters, and so my experience opening the book was, oh my gosh, who are these people? What are they talking about? And then, of course, a few pages in, one's just completely sucked in. But what's special about using letters to write a book?
Well, I think Marianne, I asked Marianne once, you know, what's with the epistolary form, Marianne? And she said, well, I thought it would be easier, which I thought was a hilarious answer. I think she made a great choice because when you're writing a historical novel, one of the things that strains your readers' credulity is the idea that, you know, manifold historical events are happening to the same few people. But because we have 26 different characters, we have there's a reasonable explanation for the variety of experiences that they have had during the occupation. I also think that the first person voices we get to use in the book, as these letter writers express themselves in their correspondence, creates a really great energy, and it's always fun to have different voices to work with. And I also think Marianne didn't like to write dialogue, so I think that was a really clever way to avoid having to write too much direct dialogue.
And it winds up being very intimate, though.
Yes, it does. I mean, you feel like you know these people because you're plunged right into their world.
One of the things that I think is interesting about this book in relationship to why we're talking about it, which is that it's the One Book, One Community selection this year here in Evansville, is that it's very much about reading in community. And one of the characters, Amelia Moggery, talks about this.
Turns speaking about the books we'd read. At the start, we tried to be calm and objective, but that soon fell away. And the purpose of the speakers was to goad the listeners into wanting to read the book themselves. Once two members had read the same book, they could argue, which was our great delight. We read books, talked books, argued over books, and became dearer and dearer to one another. Other islanders asked to join us, and our evenings together became bright, lively times. We could almost forget, now and then, the darkness outside.
Reading, on the one hand, can be so private, but Annie Barrows, what is special about reading in community?
Well, I think that because people, when people talk about books, they have an automatic bond, you know, that they, even if they disagree about the book, they are conversing about something that they feel deeply. That's how communities are created. There is a world within a world that you make around a book, and I think it's oftentimes a nice alternative to the quotidian reality that we have to spend most of our time in.
There's a rumor that there's going to be a movie made from this. Is that true?
It's a true rumor. No. the book has been optioned. And I have no idea. I get these odd dispatches from movie land, and I can't really tell what they mean. But I've recently gotten a few dispatches that make me think this really might turn into a movie. How thrilling.
So you are excited about that, even though you'd have to let go and see some of these characters come to life through someone else's vision.
Oh, yes, I am thrilled about that. I mean, I think I let go when the book was optioned because it becomes a different piece of art. It's the piece of art that Marianne and I made is the book. The piece of art that the movie will be is somebody else's piece of art. But I would like to see it. I think it would be thrilling.
Going to ask you one more thing. You've become so successful with this, and of course you also have a wonderful children's series, Ivy and Bean. You're traveling around, you're talking, you're doing all kinds of things other than writing. Do you still have time to write?
That's a great question. Sometimes I think I don't, but yes, I do. There are long stretches where I go into hibernation, and I stay at home, and I don't leave, and I write. But then there are these bursts of traveling, where I go out in the world. It's like having a two personalities.
Is there another adult novel in the works?
Yes, there's another one coming. Not a sequel, but another adult novel.
Author Annie Barrows speaking to us from her home in Northern California. She's the co-author of the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Pie Society. She'll speak at the Victory Theater in Evansville on Wednesday evening. The event is free and open to the public. Thanks so much for being on the show, Annie.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's time now for the weekly segment we call Tech Talk, where our associate producer and engineer Tony Voss brings us the latest news and tips from the technology world. And this week, a change to Google Plus.
That's right, Mike. These days, there are really only two social networks. There's the one everyone uses and hates, which is Facebook, and the one everyone loves and doesn't ever use, which is Google Plus. And according to our technology expert, Justin Williams, Google is finally adding a feature that has been much sought after.
And this is something that when Google Plus first came out, a lot of people were clamoring for as well. And by people, I mean brands. Google Plus finally introduced the concept of business and brand pages that you can now add to your specific circles. So the quick and easy ones to mention are Google set up pages for Android. They set up ones for Chrome. I set one up for my company. WNIN could set one up if they wanted to. And then people that are using Google Plus can then add those brands into their specific circles. And then if the person adds them to their circles, the brand can add them back to their circles as well if they want. And it's another way for companies and brands to kind of market to you and get information about their products out to you. I don't necessarily know if anyone was asking for another venue to be advertised to, but Google Plus is now offering that to us.
Yeah, I don't necessarily think that getting to know that I can subscribe to Coke and hear their announcements is really going to make me want to use Google Plus any more than I do, and I don't use it at all.
Yeah, Google Plus is it's odd in that they've got millions of users, but I don't know how many of those millions are active. And the reason they have millions of users is because millions upon millions of people use Google Search, they use Gmail, they use Google Docs, they use all of these services that require having a Google account, and then by proxy, that is enabled as a Google Plus account. So everyone is pretty much signed up as a Google Plus user, but I don't know that the vast majority of people are actually going to Plus actively and Plus wanting stuff and posting comments on there. Based on all the people I've got in my circles, that answer would be no. And kind of my gauge for this sort of stuff is when is my family going to mention Google Plus to me, or when am I going to actually see them using the service? I have some of my family members in circles, but I can't remember the last time they actually published something on there or Plus One'd it.
If we can extrapolate this issue into a little bit more of a larger concern for Google as a whole, outside of the search function and the search algorithm, which is really amazing, and its integrated image search, which is probably one of the coolest things out there, pretty much everything else that Google does is just finding something that someone else does and saying, hey, we've got one of those also.
Yeah, Google's really big on these Me Too products because if you look at a Google video when that first came out a couple of years ago, that was their answer to YouTube before they actually ended up buying YouTube. Google Docs was their answer to some other stuff that some Web 2.0 startups were doing, and they just ended up buying that. It doesn't seem like Google has done anything ridiculously original and cutting edge since search, since Google News, since their first sort of products. It seems like they've gotten to this point where they're such a big company that they feel like they need to be in all these different markets, but they're not great in any of them. And I'm starting to wonder if Larry Page, now that he's the CEO, realizes this, and this is why he started to cut back on some of the things that Google has been doing. And he slashed the Google Labs project. He slashed a couple of other services that were kind of fledgling along. And they've put a really big focus on Google Plus, and they've even started to tie a lot of other services like Google Reader and YouTube to integrate directly into Google Plus. But still, I don't see anything that differentiates Google Plus enough from Facebook that makes me want to recommend people using it over Facebook.
And then taking a look at the playing field for social networks, there were a lot more startup social networks just a year or two ago. Those have pretty much fallen by the wayside. Now it seems to be down to Facebook and Google Plus, with Twitter as kind of its own thing that doesn't seem to really factor in. A couple of years down the line, Justin, do you think there's going to be a Google Plus, or will Facebook pretty much stand on its own?
I think Google Plus can stand on its own too, but I don't think they can stand on their own if they just try to copy everything Facebook does. I think Google Plus can stand on its own solely because everyone has a Google account and everyone uses a Google service or two. So by having it directly integrated into your other services that you're using by proxy, then you're going to be sharing content directly into Google Plus. But in terms of people choosing, if they were stuck with, I can only have Google Plus or I can only have Facebook, I think the answer is going to be they're going to go where their friends are and where their family is. And right now that's Facebook. And I can't see any point where that's going to change right now unless Facebook does something ridiculously, insanely stupid.
Yes, and it's 11-11-11. So in honor of Nigel Tufnel Day, the Tech Talk DLC goes to 11 with the look at the end of the bitter battle between Apple and Adobe over mobile Flash. That story is going to be at WNIN.org, where you can also podcast past episodes of The Trend and send us questions or suggestions through Facebook, Twitter, or email, not Google Plus, though. Quite exciting, this computer magic. Thanks, Micah.
Thank you, Tony. This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. We continue our literary edition of the show with two more authors now, Nicole Louise Reed and Anna Mantharam. They both have new novels out, So There and After the Tsunami, respectively, and they've both been featured at the University of Southern Indiana's Ropewalk Visiting Writers Reading Series. Welcome, Nicole.
Thank you.
And great to meet you, Anna.
Good meeting you. Thanks.
Now, I have to say, I'm struck by the fact that you both have very pleasant biographies. You both have, husbands, a young son, I imagine, a Labrador or Golden Retriever romping in the picket-fenced yard. Why do you write such gritty, dark novels and stories, Nicole? Where does this come from?
I want it to hurt. I've always loved reading anything gruesome, gritty, hard. I don't know. That's what I enjoy. A character that's put through some sort of psychological, emotional stresses, tortures, and comes out the other side.
So is that something that you're exploring, a different dimension that you know nothing about, or is that channeling something dark from within yourself?
Well, nothing literally true, but I think, imagined, hyperbolized, emotional truth.
What about you, Anna?
I agree with Nicole. I've always really been interested in dark characters, and I find there's a particular beauty in that darkness, and it can be a vehicle, especially I know in my novel, it can really propel people forward and, into something more beautiful, I think.
And yet, you have in your book, After the Tsunami, you tell the story of an Indian orphanage where children go after a tsunami wipes away their families and their villages. There's also hope in the book.
Yeah, there is a lot of hope. And I leave it to the readers to find that hope, because there is a lot of brutality, but there's also a lot of light, too, I feel.
Does darkness and grittiness have to be counterbalanced, Nicole?
Absolutely. I was just talking with one of my classes yesterday about this in a workshop, that we can't have only pain, only darkness. There's got to be moments of light that serve as little breaths for the reader, because we as readers can't endure such such sadness, such grief, without a little bit of air, a little bit of hope.
So is writing, or reading rather, for the reader, is this an escape from real life, or is it getting deeper into it, do you think?
Probably both.
Yeah, I think so, definitely.
So why do you write? When did you, I know you wrote a book about a story about a pig on a Manthrum very, very early on. Did you know then, when you were writing about an evil pig and an evil family, that you were going to be a writer?
No, my parents wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer. So in our family, those were the only two valid professions for Indians. So no, I didn't actually for a long time. I always wrote, and my parents always thought it was just a cute little hobby. And it wasn't until probably as an undergrad, and I had a professor tell me, you really have talent, you really should go on to grad school, and you really should pursue this, that I started calling myself a writer, and I thought it was pretty cool.
What did it feel like the first time you did that?
I thought I was a rock star. I mean, I thought it was really neat to finally admit it to myself. I think I always knew that. I just never really admitted it, and to just finally, come out of the proverbial closet was pretty cool.
I had a similar experience of being in grad school, or being in undergrad school rather, and delaying taking a core class that people were required to take. I could take creative writing, and I put it off because I didn't want anyone to grade my writing. I hear this from my students all the time. And so I finally took it as a senior and my last semester of school, and was told by the teacher at the end when he gave back our portfolios, hey, this one poem's really good, you should send it out. And I mean, that was enough for me to get petted, you know, was enough.
And now you're being graded by critics.
Yeah.
In the public sphere, which has got to be much worse than a letter grade at the top.
Yeah,
of the
it never ends, Micah. No. They're just different people sitting in position of grading.
What's it?
Go ahead. I was going to say, as a writer, though, I think you learn how to deal with rejection. So I think by now the rejection doesn't sting as much.
Yeah, the rejection is such a part of the publication process for most writers. You know, there's the few fairy tale stories of instant acceptance, but mostly we send out a manuscript and get it back, send it out and get it back, and get those little, you know, Xeroxed form letters that say, thank you, we've read your submission with interest, but have decided not to accept it. So, yeah, we get to the point where you just kind of build a thicker skin.
So what was, for you, Nicole Reed, what was the point where you broke through?
You mean in publication?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, when I was in grad school, I was publishing stories and doing some awards and things like that. So by the time I finished my thesis manuscript, which was my first book, my novel, I had published many of the chapters as short stories, and then was picked up by an agent who saw one of those stories in a magazine. So you know, for me, that was kind of the beginning of forward momentum as a professional writer.
What about you, Anna Mantharam?
The first story I got published was in grad school, so that was pretty exciting for me. And then this novel, this is my first book,
right.
So it's really, really exciting for me. And this was just through a contest that I entered and didn't think anything of it. And then I got an email saying that they had chosen it as a finalist. So.
And that meant publication.
Yep.
And now you're traveling on the back of this book.
I am. It all started because of a wedding, my friend's wedding in Oakland. And so from there, my family and I, we decided to make a big book tour out of it. And I like telling people I'm on a book tour.
It's pretty impressive.
Yeah. When you write a book, like after the tsunami, I guess you were looking at some of the news about the actual Indian Ocean tsunami that happened earlier in the past decade, and looking at some of your own experiences being part of an Indian family.
Yeah, it was a combination of things, really. You know, I've always been interested in caste system in India and violence against children in particular. And so I've always done research on that all my life. And then that coupled with my sister's experiences at a boarding school in India, my own experiences in India, and then just talking to my family, people I'd have known have gone back, and all of that just kind of came together, and as well as the tsunami, and just kind of vomited into this book, you know, and then that's how it happened.
How long did it take to write?
5 years.
So it was that's a long period of throwing up.
It's a long expulsion, yes. But well worth it.
Absolutely.
When you do research, and I know you do a lot of it for a book like this, how beholden to that research do you feel? Do you feel like somebody can read this book and should walk away with an accurate understanding of, say, the caste system in India?
I think it's definitely authentic in regards to caste, but the disclaimer is it is a work of fiction, so there are definitely fictional elements. And for me in particular, I find that if I do too much research, I find it's confining to me. I think as a fiction writer, one of the biggest tools that we have in our toolbox is our imagination. And I think if we can create a world solely through our creativity and it's authentic and people believe it's authentic, then we've done our job.
Yeah, and I think the authenticity of the human aspect matters far more than authenticity in any other regard.
Yeah. You write in a very, I guess you could be considered a Southern writer, even though you don't sound Southern to my ears.
Well, when you hear me read, it comes out. But yeah, I don't so much talk that way.
You recently were in New Orleans for a research trip. What were you doing there?
I was serving as a sponge. I was soaking things up. Mostly I was getting out of the city because I don't see myself writing about the city, New Orleans or any city really. But so I did three different swamp tours, mostly so that I could get my son out on the water and have him, much to my chagrin, feed a marshmallow to an alligator. That was the most commercial and most vile of the tours. But we did a couple of really wonderful tours as well. A kayaking tour on the Pascagoula River. And Pascagoula is pretty near and dear to me because I wrote about it in my first novel and was thinking of this research trip as something to prepare me to write possibly a sequel or just another novel set in the same area. So going to see the river as well as the town that had been pretty devastated by Katrina. I mean, there were just cement slabs where houses had been. Was pretty great.
We're talking books with Anna Manthrum and Nicole Louise Reed. More after a break. This is The Trend.
You're listening to The Trend on 88.3 WNIN and WNIN.org. Support for the program today comes from Evansville Day School, presenting an evening of discovery featuring the upper school at Evansville Day School on November 17th, 5:30 to 6:30 p.m., including dinner, panel discussions, tours, meeting the faculty, and seeing programs in action. Reservations at 476-3039. Evansville Day School, preparing for college, preparing for life.
This is The Trend. I'm Micah Schweitzer. Still ahead, our weekly feature, The Arts Notebook. Right now, we're talking with Anna Manthrum and Nicole Louise Reed from USI's Ropewalk Visiting Writers Reading Series. Nicole, I have to follow up on what you were talking about a minute ago, which is your research trip. How is a research trip different from a vacation?
For a writer, it looks a lot the same, I have to admit. Lots of eating, lots of museums, lots of walking around. You know, I mean, what I was going there for was the colors of shutters on houses and the way that you have to look down at the cobbly brick in order to not trip and fall, and then you still trip and fall because it's so undulatory. You know, that's what I was there for, and so a little vacation too.
Well, I know you've selected something to read, and why don't you take a moment to read a selection?
Sure. This comes from my new book, So There, Collection of Stories. It's the first story in the collection called If You Must Know. These are the early cicadas, 4 years ahead of schedule, chirping, shrilling, blistering through their skins. 13 years ago, the night was electric with their noise, and one burrowed right into me, that little flab of skin beneath the arm socket. Thinking me a tree because I lay so still at the thought of what we'd just done beneath the water oak, Wallace and me. It broke through my skin and climbed deep within, planning to live there for its next 17 years, sucking and sapping what it can from me. And so there must be something in people akin to the marrow of a tree's sweet pulp, because my locust is alive and waiting. We went to all the doctors, of course, each grabbing hold of one of my corners like an old shrunken fitted sheet that pops off just when you thought you had it. They were wanting to slice me open to extract the thing, but I was 15 and big enough to put up a genuine fuss. You see, I felt romantic about it. Everything was sacred that day. The sky such a blue as kitten's eyes, the grass beneath us so plush with summer, the oak perfectly leaning for shading us, the creek moving slower than breeze. The absolute shrieking of the cicadas waking in the bark, and yes, the one locust burrowing into my armpit.
That's written from a woman's voice. Your voice, though, changing like you said it would, to read that, voices seem very important in your writing.
Absolutely. And in what I read, I mean, I was speaking about this earlier, I audiate when I read, meaning that I hear my own voice reading the words as if, you know, reading aloud every time I read. And And I've always, I mean, when I was a kid, I never wanted to read. I wanted my mother to read to me. I wanted somebody's voice inhabiting the words. And I guess I'm still like that. I want somebody speaking, and I always want the printed page to sound like it's somebody speaking.
Well, let's turn to you, Anamantharam. I know you have a selection as well from your first novel, After the Tsunami. And you're writing from the voice of a man who is remembering his childhood.
Yeah, and I often get asked the question, why a man? Why not a woman? And the answer is, there's a lot of different answers. You know, there was a certain depth of brutality that I wanted to convey that I felt was best with a man. And I've always been very comfortable writing male characters. I grew up with my brother, was very close with my brother, and so I've just kind of adopted that persona. And even in current works, my new novel is a male protagonist as well, so I can't seem to get away.
Well, let's hear what you're going to read.
I'm going to read from a chapter later on in the novel, so hopefully it's not a spoiler. And I chose it because it's when Siddhartha is an older man, and there's a certain elegance in the prose that I think comes through. My children want to see where I grew up. They want to visit the ocean. I take them to the beach in Chennai, then Madras, but so much has changed now. Though I still see destitution, my eyes are hopeful. I pass a coin to a child, and soon 50 children have surrounded me. My wife trembles. I enroll note after note until she tells me to stop. "Why is everyone so poor?" my wife whispers. She has never seen such poverty. For her, suffering exists only in the crevices of her canvases. "Because they don't have enough, Mom," my daughter says. She is logical, like me. "I know, but why?" she asks again. The question goes unanswered. I know sooner or later my children will want to see the place of my destruction and subsequent birth. Though it is now burned, they will want to see the ashes, feel the walls of my prison. They think it will be cathartic. I think it will be harrowing.
Now, you get to go on book tours and read out loud in part to hawk the wares. But what is it about hearing an author reading their work? Why do you think, is there something special about that? Is that important? Is there something beyond the commercial?
Well, I kind of agree with what Nicole was saying about when she was read aloud to. I feel like when I read my work aloud, it's like when my parents read to me when I was a kid. You know, there's a certain magic to that. And I get to interpret the text the way that I wrote it. I get to emphasize what I feel needs emphasis, linger maybe on passages that I feel are important. But I really think that interpretation is up to the person reading it. I mean, my interpretation is not the correct necessarily. And everybody has their own opinions. And, you know, I kind of liken it to, you know, being a director of a film. Everybody's going to direct it in a different way, but there's no wrong way of doing it.
And Nicole, you actually head up the Rope Walk Visiting Writers Reading Series at USI. Why have artists, writers come in and read?
Well, to benefit our students, frankly. I mean, we want the students to see writers who are working as professional writers so that our students can imagine, you know, what is the progression of my career? What can it be? What can it look like? So we have writers who teach, writers who do grant writing, like Anam, and we have writers who come in at different stages. I try, especially this year and as I plan for next year's lineup, to bring in writers who are early enough in their career that they, you know, have hit a stride, have hit with contests and publication, but are young enough in those careers that our students can really relate to them and find that path into a career, so that there's not this great divide that they just can't relate to a writer.
I wanted to ask you, in the time that we have left, some advice for any aspiring writers who are listening right now. And hearing both of you talk, it seems that there was somebody who pushed you in both cases. It's not that you're not self-made in that sense.
Sure, yeah. The fundamental bit of advice for me to give is always to read what moves you and made you in the first place want to write. For me, that was hearing different voices and wanting to create those kinds of voices or my own versions of them in my own work. And you know, reading feeds my work in that way and can really feed my students' work.
Yeah, and I would say the same thing as well as, you know, treat writing like a job. Take it seriously, you know, don't slack off, you know. And just because you might not be getting a regular paycheck, it doesn't mean it's not a job and it's not important to you.
What are you reading right now?
I'm reading Nicole's new book. I've started that and am instantly taken in. I'm also trying to go back and read some of the classics, so I'm in the middle of Madame Bovary right now as well.
And what about you, Nicole Reed?
I'm reading Adam's book and completely taken with the rainbow. I'm also reading a lot of books for next year's Rope Walk. I'm reading some Donald Ray Pollock, some Bruce Machart. And I'm also reading with my classes for the current Rope Walk season and next semester.
Nicole Louise Reed and Anna Mantharam's work has been featured in USI's Rope Walk Visiting Writers Reading Series, which also airs on WNIN as part of the show Regional Voices. Anna will also read and sign books at Barnes & Noble in Evansville on Saturday at 2 p.m. Just ahead, the Arts Notebook. The trend continues in a minute.
This is The Trend on 88.3 WNIN and on WNIN.org, where you can not only listen to us live, but also hear past editions of The Trend in podcast form, including this one a little bit later on this weekend. The Trend also re-airs on Sundays at 6 p.m. Central Time, which you might already know if you're hearing this now.
I'm Micah Schweitzer. This is The Trend on WNIN, and it's time now for our weekly segment, The Arts Notebook. Roger McBain from The Courier and Press is here. Hi, Roger.
Good morning.
And Roger, one of the recurring themes on this segment is theater, and this weekend is another busy one on area stages, including at the University of Southern Indiana.
That's right. They're opening Jonathan Larson's modern rock opera version of Giacomo Puccini's La Boheme, Rent. It's in this case set in New York, late 20th century New York in the East Village instead of Paris in the 19th century. And these are struggling artists dealing in a time of AIDS in this case rather than consumption in the Puccini opera.
And set in New York, as you say, and the, I guess the entire cast, you write, took a research trip to go to see the place that they're portraying.
They got a number of grants from various areas of the university for the director, Eric Altheide, to take the entire cast to New York. They visited the area in the East Village where this was set, where the playwright wrote it and wrote the lyrics. They went to an off-Broadway production of Rent. They met the actors. They shot some video for their production there, crammed a lot into 4 or 5 days.
And this is playing at the Millette Studio Theater. So how does this translate into what that theater now looks like?
They have built up the stage on one end of it. They've used a lot of steel to create kind of a cityscape, fire escapes, that sort of thing. There are going to be video displays in the background that will actually show video that they shot. Mm. That's one of the people in this story is a videographer. But it shows things that he shot, and it will show flashbacks of things in his life and carry that through. Beyond that, the actors will come into this with a very thorough understanding of the area and that sort of thing. And one thing I should point out before we move off from that is that it is sold out entirely. They had a second show announced, and it sold out within 8 hours.
So this is your chance to hear what you're missing out on, I guess.
Yeah.
And I guess if we head across town from USI to the University of Evansville, we're dealing with some sold-out shows there, too.
They are going to present Gypsy. That's opening tonight. Both of these shows open tonight, as a matter of fact. I'm going to have to go to one tonight and another tomorrow night. But it's Arthur Lorentz, Stephen Sondheim, and Jules Stein's musical based on the life of Gypsy Rose Lee, her her sister and their mother hauling them around the country.
And remind us who Gypsy Rose Lee was.
Gypsy Rose Lee was a very famous striptease artist whose autobiography is the basis for this musical.
Now, this is pretty far removed from minivans and soccer games, but you could say the show is about so-called helicopter parents.
Mama Rose is a stage mom on steroids, taking her children around the country, barnstorming these burlesque theaters, basically really trying to push them to become stars and I think maybe live vicariously a bit herself through their own careers.
And the show's choreographer had some experience in this kind of a world.
Ricky Smith Newman is a longtime dancer, choreographer here in Evansville. And she actually grew up in a family that had a show that was based on vaudeville traditions. They were called the Magical Tapical Smiths. Her dad did magic. Her parents did tap dancing. She joined the act when she was 4 years old and performed with them until she was in her 20s.
And also on the east side, the Evansville Civic Theater Underground at the Annex is performing a play called Women of Manhattan.
It's a kind of 80s Sex in the City kind of story about three women who have flourishing careers but whose emotional lives are a wreck, and they're looking back over their lives and trying to adapt with some of that.
And now finally, just to say that we stuck with today's literary theme, there are works by a few favorite writers that are coming to life on area high school stages next weekend.
Signature School's going to present a Thurber Carnival based on the humor of James Thurber in The Victory. Students will stage an adaptation of Bram Stoker's Dracula at Modern Day High School. And the Henderson High School Drama Club will present The Canterbury Tales or Geoffrey Chaucer's Flying Circus.
Okay, and the other three plays Roger McBain mentioned all open this weekend. The details are in his articles in Thursday's Courier and Press, also online at courierpress.com. Roger, great to talk with you.
Thank you.
One final note, Tuesday was a good day for Indiana's mayoral incumbents, but in Evansville, the incumbent didn't run, so a new mayor was elected. Lloyd Winicky will be only the third Republican to serve in Evansville since the mid-1950s. We'll have an interview with him on a future edition of The Trend. On the next show, Evansville is opening a new VA clinic. How will that affect the care veterans receive? And is Evansville the new Hollywood? Probably not, but there is a local film scene. Send us your questions and comments about veterans care and local movie making to us via Facebook, Twitter, email, or Carrier Pigeon. Just click on The Trend at WNIN.org. You'll also find podcasts there as well as at CourierPress.com. We're also on iTunes and in the NPR podcast directory. The Trend is a production of WNIN in collaboration with the Evansville Courier and Press. Our associate producer and engineer is Tony Voss. Our producer at the Courier and Press is Ella Johnson Watson. Our intern is Carolina Tote. The show's theme music was composed by Jeffrey Osman. I'm Micah Schweitzer. We'll talk again next week. This is WNIN-FM, Evansville, Henderson, and Owensboro.